This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Great at Work, how top performers do less, work better, and achieve more, by Morton T. Hansen. Read by Robert Petcock. The assessment from Chapter 7 can be found on the PDF that comes with this program.
1. The Secrets to Great Performance. After 9 grueling interviews, I landed my dream job as management consultant at the Boston Consulting Group in London. I'll never forget how I showed up on my first day, wearing an elegant blue suit bought for the occasion with Oxford lace-up shoes to match. My girlfriend had given me a sleek, soft briefcase of the sort bankers carry around. As I strode through the front doors of the office in posh Devonshire House right near Piccadilly, I looked the part but felt intimidated. I yearned to make a mark, so I followed what I thought was a brilliant strategy. I would work crazy hours. I didn't have much relevant work experience. Heck, I didn't have any. It was my first real job. I was 24 years old and had just finished a master's degree in finance from the London School of Economics. What I lacked in experience, I would make up for by staying late in the office. Over the next 3 years, I worked 60, 70, 80, even 90 hours per week. I drank an endless stream of weak British coffee and survived on a supply of chocolate bars I kept in my top drawer. It got to the point where I knew the names of the cleaning staff who arrived at 5 in the morning. As you can imagine, my girlfriend soon wanted the briefcase back. One day, as I struggled through an intense merger and acquisition project, I happened upon some slides created by a teammate. I'll call her Natalie. Paging through her analysis, I confronted an uncomfortable truth. Natalie's work was better than mine. Her analysis contained crisper insights, more compelling ideas. Her slides boasted a clean, elegant layout that was more pleasing to the eye and easier to comprehend, which, in turn, made her analysis even more persuasive. Yet, one evening in the office, when I went to look for her, she wasn't there. I asked a guy sitting near her desk where she was, and he replied that she'd gone home for the night. He explained that Natalie never worked late. She worked from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., no nights, no weekends. That upset me. We were both talented and had the analytical capability required of BCG consultants. She had no more experience in the field than I did, yet she did better while working less. 3 years later, I left BCG to embark on an academic career. I earned a PhD from Stanford University and went on to become a professor at Harvard Business School. From time to time, I found myself thinking back to what I called the Natalie question. Why had she performed better in fewer hours? She must have carried some secrets explaining her results. I began to wonder about performance in general and decided to focus my research on corporate performance. Starting in 2002, Jim Collins and I spent 9 years working on our book Great by Choice as a sequel to Jim's Good to Great. Both books offer empirically validated frameworks that account for great performance in companies. That's nice if you're leading a business, but what about the rest of us? After we finished the project, I decided to develop a similarly validated framework for individual performance. It was time to discover why Natalie had done better than I, and more generally, to tackle the big question. Why do some people perform great at work while others don't? Social scientists and management experts explain performance at work by pointing to people's innate gifts and natural strengths. How often have you heard phrases like, "She's a natural at sales," or "He's a brilliant engineer"? One influential book, titled The War for Talent, argues that a company's ability to recruit and retain talent determines its success. The popular Strengths Finder approach advocates that you find a job that taps into your natural strengths and then focus on developing those further. These talent-based explanations are deeply embedded in our perceptions of what makes for success. But are they right? Some work experts take issue with the talent view. They argue that an individual's sustained effort is just as critical, or even more so, in determining success. In one variant of this work hard paradigm, people perform because they have grit, persevering against obstacles over the long haul. In another, people maximize efforts by doing more. They take on many assignments and are busy running to lots of meetings. That's the approach I subscribed to while at BCG, where I put in long hours in an effort to accomplish more. Many people believe that working harder is key to success. Talent, effort, and also luck undoubtedly explain why some succeed and others don't, but I wasn't satisfied with these arguments. They didn't account for why Natalie performed better than I, nor did they explain the performance differences I had observed between equally hard-working and talented people. I decided to take a different approach, exploring whether the way some people work, their specific work practices as opposed to the sheer amount of effort they exert, accounts for greatness at work. That led me to explore the idea of working smart, whereby people seek to maximize output per hour of work. The phrase, work smarter, not harder, has been thrown around so much that it has become a cliché. Who wants to work dumb? But many people do, in fact, work dumb because they don't know exactly how to work smart. And I don't blame them, because it's hard to obtain solid guidance. I scanned for existing advice on how to work smarter, and the picture I arrived at was incoherent and overwhelming. Every author seemed to say something different. Prioritize. Delegate. Keep a calendar. Avoid distractions. Set clear goals. Execute better. Influence people. Inspire. Manage up. Manage down. Network. Tap into passion. Find a purpose. The list went on, more than 100 pieces of advice. So what is really going on? If Natalie worked smarter than I, what exactly did she and other top performers do? What secrets to their great performance do they harbor? I decided to find out. After years of study, what I found surprised me a great deal and shattered conventional wisdom. The Performance Study. In 2011, I launched one of the most comprehensive research projects ever undertaken on individual performance at work. I recruited a team of researchers with expertise in statistical analysis and began generating a framework, a set of hypotheses about which specific behaviors led to high performance. I considered the scattered findings I had found in more than 200 published academic studies, and I incorporated insights from my previous discussions with hundreds of managers and executives. I also drew on in-depth interviews with 120 professionals and undertook a 300-person survey pilot. In the final step, we tested the emerging framework in a survey study of 5,000 managers and employees. To organize the vast array of potential work smart factors, I grouped them into categories that scholars regard as important for job performance. We can think of work as consisting of job design characteristics, what a person is supposed to do, skill development, how a person improves, motivational factors, why a person exerts effort, and relational dimensions, with whom and how a person interacts. Once I had settled on these broad categories, I examined factors within each, identifying those that previous research suggested were key. With this initial list of factors in hand, my team and I designed a 96-item survey instrument, piloting it with a sample of 300 bosses and employees. We also tracked how many hours people worked each week, and we measured their performance relative to their peers. That way, we could compare the effects of hours worked and our work smart factors on performance. We spent months poring over statistical results from the pilot and our notes from in-depth interviews. We winnowed down the number of plausible factors until we arrived at 8 main factors. After some more analysis, we discovered that 2 were similar, so we combined them into 1. In the end, we discovered that 7 work-smart practices seemed to explain a substantial portion of performance. It always seems to be 7, doesn't it? When you work smart, you select a tiny set of priorities and make huge efforts in those chosen areas, what I call the work scope practice. You focus on creating value, not just reaching preset goals. Targeting. You eschew mindless repetition in favor of better skills practice. Quality learning. You seek roles that match your passion with a strong sense of purpose. Inner motivation. You shrewdly deploy influence tactics to gain the support of others. Advocacy. You cut back on wasteful team meetings and make sure that the ones you do attend spark vigorous debate. Rigorous teamwork. You carefully pick which cross-unit projects to get involved in and say no to less productive ones. Disciplined collaboration. This is a pretty comprehensive list. The first 4 relate to mastering your own work, while the remaining 3 concern mastering working with others. Not what we expected. These 7 practices upend conventional thinking about how you should work. I had thought, for instance, that people who prioritized well would perform well, and they did, but the best performers in our study also did something else. Once they had focused on a few priorities, they obsessed over those tasks to produce quality work. That extreme dedication to their priorities created extraordinary results. Top performers did less and more. Less volume of activities, more concentrated effort. This insight overturns much conventional thinking about focusing that urges you to choose a few tasks to prioritize. Choice is only half of the equation. You also need to obsess. This finding led us to reformulate the work scope practice and call it Do Less, Then Obsess. Our findings also overturned another convention. How many times have you heard, do what you love? Find a role that taps into your passion and you will be energized and do a better job. Sure enough, we found that people who were highly passionate about their jobs performed better. But we also came across passionate people who didn't perform well, and people whose passion led them astray, like the poor guy who pursued his passion for graphics design and ended up running down his retirement account and having no job and no income. Follow your passion, we found, can be dangerous advice. Our top performers took a different approach. They strove to find roles that contributed value to the organization and society and then matched passion with that sense of purpose. The matching of passion and purpose, and not passion alone, produced the best results. Our results overturned yet another typical view, the idea that collaboration is necessarily good and that more is better. Experts advise us to tear down silos in organizations, collaborate more, build large professional networks, and use lots of high-tech communication tools to get work done. Well, my research shows that convention to be dead wrong. Top performers collaborate less. They carefully choose which projects and tasks to join and which to flee, and they channel their efforts and resources to excel in the few chosen ones. They discipline their collaboration. Our study also disputes the popular idea that the path to top performance lies in practicing a skill for 10,000 hours. Our best performers in the workplace did something else, practicing what I call the learning loop at work, as we'll discuss in Chapter 4. These and other surprising insights turned out to be critical. The very best people didn't just work smart in a conventional sense, but pursued more nuanced practices, like doing less and obsessing, and matching purpose with passion. Comparing these 7 practices, I realized that they all embodied the idea of selectivity. Whenever they could, top performers carefully selected which priorities, tasks, collaborations, team meetings, committees, analyses, customers, new ideas, steps in a process, and interactions to undertake, and which to neglect or reject. Yet this more nuanced way of working smart wasn't just about being selective. The very best redesigned their work so that they would create the most value, a term we will define in Chapter 3, and then they applied intense, targeted efforts in their selected work activities. Based on these findings, I arrived at a more precise definition of working smart. To work smart means to maximize the value of your work by selecting a few activities and applying intense, targeted effort. Testing the new theory. To test our framework of the 7 work smart practices, my team and I modified our survey instrument and administered it to 5,000 managers and employees across a wide range of jobs and industries in corporate America. We sampled bosses and direct reports in addition to employees so as not to rely on self-reported data only. We surveyed sales reps, lawyers, trainers, actuaries, brokers, medical doctors, software programmers, engineers, store managers, plant foremen, marketers, human resource people, consultants, nurses, and my personal favorite, a Las Vegas casino dealer. Some of these people occupied senior positions, but most were supervisors, office managers, department heads, or employees in low-level positions. The 5,000 people represented 15 industry sectors and 22 job functions. Almost half, 45%, were women. 2 of the 7 practices revealed a gender difference. Age groups ranged from millennials to those over 50. Education level varied from those with less than a bachelor's degree, 20% of the sample, to people with a master's degree or higher, 22%. My aim was to develop, test, and share a smart work theory that most people could use to improve their individual performance. We ran our 5,000-person data set through a rigorous statistical method called regression analysis. It turned out that our 7 work smart practices went a long way toward explaining differences in performance. In fact, they accounted for a whopping 66% of the variation in performance among the 5,000 people in our dataset. We can compare that to other fields to get an idea of how remarkable this effect is. Smoking will kill you, we're told, yet smoking only explains 18% of variation in people's average life expectancy in the developed world, according to one study. Having a good salary is considered crucial for building lifelong financial resources, yet income only explains 33% of differences in people's net worth, according to a study of U.S. citizens between ages 18 and 65. The basketball star Stephen Curry is famous for hitting 3-point shots 22 feet away from the basket, yet he has landed just 44% of these shots during his professional career. These benchmark numbers from other fields indicate how substantial 66% really is in explaining an outcome like individual performance. By contrast, other factors we tested, such as educational background, company tenure, age, gender, and hours worked, combined to account for only 10% of the differences in performance. Hours worked per week mattered, but as I'll explain in Chapter 3, the relationship to performance was more complicated than the simple work harder view suggests. The other 24% of the difference was unexplained and possibly included factors such as luck or talent. Think about what these results mean. The talent and effort explanations still play a significant role in determining how individuals perform. But the real key to individual performance is the 7 work smarter practices. We now have the answer to the Natalie question of why some people perform so well, although I will never know exactly what Natalie did to deliver such stellar work. But I know something far more important. A systematic and empirically tested way to lift performance that holds across jobs. By improving on the 7 practices, you can boost your performance beyond what it would be if you relied on talent, luck, or the sheer number of hours worked. The more a person in our study adopted the 7 practices in their work, the better they performed. If you rank in only the 21st percentile in your adoption of the 7 practices, your performance is likely to be lackluster, in the bottom 21st percentile. However, if you crank up your proficiency at these 7 practices, jumping to the 90th percentile, your performance is likely to be in the 89th percentile, according to our predictions. That's becoming a top performer. How to work at your best. For all that has been written about performance, no book, to my knowledge, has presented an evidence-based, comprehensive understanding of what enables individuals to perform at the highest level at work. Great at Work fills this gap. It gives you a simple and practical framework that you can use to work at your best. Think of it as a complement to Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, updated to reflect the realities of work today and backed by an unprecedented statistical analysis. Each chapter presents a smart practice and offers concrete advice for how you can include it in your own work. By using the word practice, I want to emphasize that you can incorporate these ideas into your daily work and make them a habit, just like you would other routines like grabbing that morning coffee, checking your mail, and exercising. You can start small and build up these routines bit by bit until you master them. To inspire and guide you in how to apply these ideas, I tell stories of people from all walks of life who have adopted one or more of these practices and achieved outsized results. You'll meet Stephen Birdsall, a senior manager who found a way to carve out a new business in the software company SAP. You'll encounter Genevieve Gay, a hotel concierge who infused her work with passion and purpose. I'll introduce you to Greg Green, a principal who accomplished a dramatic turnaround of his failing high school with inspiration from an unlikely source. You'll encounter an emergency room nurse who found a way for her department to save more heart attack patients while doing less work. You'll meet a consumer products CEO whose unusual approach to team meetings helped him achieve a top 1% performance record. You'll also come across a small business owner, a biotech engineer, a physician, a management consultant, a sushi chef, a salesperson, a factory line person, and many others who implemented at least one of the 7 practices and boosted their performance. Throughout the book, we have altered the names and settings for most of the people we interviewed from our data set. How you can live well, too. You might wonder whether people who work smarter, as I've defined it, are unhappy with their work. Under the old work hard paradigm, high achievers tend to become stressed out, even burned out. You work harder and your performance improves, but your quality of life plummets. I know mine did when I was putting in all those hours at BCG. But our study yielded a surprise. The 7 work smarter practices didn't just improve performance, they also improved people's well-being at work. As I show in Chapter 9, people in our study who worked smarter experienced better work-life balance, higher job satisfaction, and less burnout. I have met so many people who believe that they must make a trade-off between achieving at work and enjoying a happy life. They forego life outside of their jobs and put in huge amounts of hard work, long hours, and maximum effort to become top performers. Millions of people around the world sacrifice this way because they don't know how to work differently. They don't know how to work smart. But now there is a clear answer. As our study shows, you can perform exceptionally well and still have plenty of time to do things you love other than work, like being with your family and friends. Being great at work means performing in your job, infusing your work with passion and a strong sense of purpose, and living well too. How great is that? Whether you're about to graduate from college or in the middle of your career, Whether you're worried about keeping your job or simply want to do it better, I invite you to set aside your preconceived ideas about work and explore the Work Smart theory I present in this book. We'll begin with the 4 practices for mastering your own work, followed by the 3 practices to help you master working with other people. Part 1. Mastering your own work. 2. Do less, then obsess. Whatever you are, be out and out, not partial or in doubt. Henrik Ibsen. In October 1911, 2 teams were racing to be the first humans to reach the South Pole, the last major place on Earth not yet discovered. Royal British Navy Commander Robert Falcon Scott led the first team. A veteran explorer, he had led a previous expedition to Antarctica. That earlier trip had failed to reach the South Pole, but the British public had hailed Scott as a hero. Upon his return, King Edward VII summoned Scott to Balmoral Castle and anointed him commander of the Royal Victorian Order. The leader of the second team, Norwegian Roald Amundsen, had been the first explorer to navigate the Northwest Passage, the waterborne route connecting the Atlantic to the Pacific through the Arctic Archipelago in northern Canada. Driven to make history, he too had set his sights on the South Pole. Months after arriving on the continent, having endured an Antarctic winter at their respective camps, Scott and Amundsen readied their teams for the grueling journey south. Each knew of the other's presence, but not the location during the journey. There would be no maps, no communication, no rescue. Just before setting off, Amundsen jotted in his diary, "Not much visibility. Nasty breeze from south. Minus 52 degrees Celsius. The dogs clearly affected by the cold. The men, stiff in their frozen clothes, more or less satisfied after a night in the frost. Prospect of milder weather, doubtful. It would not be easy or survivable." The race began. Amundsen took the lead as both teams embarked on their 400-mile journey across the ice barrier, a 10,000-foot climb up a treacherous mountain to the polar plateau. Once there, they would face another 400-mile journey toward the pole, all the while enduring minus 60-degree Fahrenheit chills, disorienting blizzards and winds shrieking at 100 miles an hour. Scaling the mountain, Amundsen and his team struggled across deep crevasses. They survived blizzards. They slaughtered dogs for food. After 52 days, they arrived within 55 miles of the pole. Seeing no sign of Scott, Amundsen pressed on. 2 days later, Amundsen and his fellow explorers became the first in history to stand on the South Pole. They planted the Norwegian flag and then journeyed back to their base, reaching it after trudging 1,600 miles. Scott and his men, exhausted and malnourished, limped to the pole 34 days later, only to find the Norwegian flag whipping in the wind. The team slogged homeward, racing against the approaching winter. Starving, frostbitten, exhausted, they pushed forward. Hope faded. A storm pinned them down in their tents. There they would die, only 11 miles from the next depot of food and shelter. One leader and his team achieved the extraordinary, while the other team perished in the polar night. Why? What made the difference? Over the years, authors have offered several explanations. In our book, Great by Choice, Jim Collins and I attributed Amundsen's success to better pacing and self-control. Others have pointed to good planning or even luck to explain Amundsen's success and Scott's failure. However, many accounts neglect one critical part of the dramatic South Pole race: the scope of the expeditions. One team fielded superior resources, a grander ship, 187 feet versus 128 feet, a bigger budget, 40,000 pounds versus 20,000 pounds, and a larger crew, 65 versus 19 men. How could one win against such a mighty foe? It was an unfair race. Except for one thing. Amundsen's team was the one with the narrow scope. Captain Scott commanded 3 times the men and 2x the budget. He used 5 forms of transportation: dogs, motor sledges, Siberian ponies, skis, and man hauling. If one failed, he had backups. Amundsen relied on only 1 form of transportation: dogs. Had they failed, his quest would have ended. But Amundsen's dogs didn't fail. They performed. Why? It wasn't just the choice to use dogs. Scott took dogs, too. Amundsen succeeded to a large degree because he concentrated only on dogs and eschewed backup options. During his 3-year trip through the Northwest Passage, he had spent 2 winters apprenticing with Inuits who had mastered dog sledging. Running a span of dogs is hard. They are unruly animals and sometimes drop down in the snow and refuse to work. Amundsen learned from the natives how to urge dogs to run, how to drive sledges, and how to pace himself. Amundsen also obsessed over obtaining superior dogs. His research suggested that Greenlander dogs handled polar travel better than Siberian huskies. Greenland dogs were bigger and stronger, and with their longer legs, they could better traverse the snowdrift across the ice barrier and the polar plateau. Amundsen traveled to Copenhagen to enlist the help of the Danish inspector of North Greenland. As far as dogs are concerned, it is absolutely essential that I obtain the very best it is conceivable to obtain, he wrote in a follow-up letter. Naturally, I am fully aware that as a result, the price must be higher than that normally paid. He sought out expert dog runners to join his team, several more skilled than he. When the star dog driver Sverre Hassel declined, Amundsen didn't look for the next best, but kept pursuing Hassel. According to historian Roland Huntford, Amundsen now exerted all his charm and force of character to coax Hassel, after all, to sail with him. In the end, Hassel, worn down by his persistence, agreed. Scott, on the other hand, was so busy arranging for 5 separate transportation methods that he couldn't focus on any of them. Rather than venturing to Siberia to secure ponies, he sent his aide, Cecil Mears. But Mears didn't know about ponies. He was a dog expert. So Scott's team ended up with 20 ill-suited ponies, which slowed the team down in their journey to the pole. Once moving on the ice, Scott struggled to coordinate his convoy. The motor sledges started first, as they were the slowest. The pony party set out 7 days later. The dog sledges, which were the fastest, left last. Each group had to coordinate its departure and speed with the others. Scott got tangled in a complex operation, a somewhat disorganized fleet, as he noted in his diary. The convoy ended up moving as fast as the slowest method. Amundsen, meanwhile, had fixated on a single transportation mode and was speeding across the barren landscape. During the first 8 weeks, he and his small team of 4 other experts, with 4 sledges and 52 superior dogs, averaged 15 miles per day against Scott's 11. Amundsen gained at least 4 miles on Scott every day on average. By the time Amundsen reached the pole, he was more than 300 miles ahead. Amundsen had chosen one method and mastered it. He had done less, then obsessed. Do less, obsess, and perform. The story of the race to the South Pole challenges 2 common beliefs about work. The first is that we should increase the scope of our activities, pursuing multiple responsibilities and options, like taking 5 transportation methods to the South Pole. We believe that by taking on more tasks, we accomplish more and improve our performance. Doing more, as we shall see, is usually a flawed strategy. The second misconception concerns the idea of focus. Writers like Daniel Goleman and Stephen Covey have argued that people can only perform at their best if they select a few items to work on and say no to others. This view is incomplete. It overemphasizes choice as if that's the only requirement. If you are disciplined enough to choose a few priorities, you will succeed. Picking a few priorities is only half the equation. The other half is the harsh requirement that you must obsess over your chosen area of focus to excel. The term focus consists of two activities: choosing a few priorities and then dedicating your efforts toward excelling at them. Many people prioritize a few items at work, but they don't obsess. They simply do less. That's a mistake. Amundsen didn't win just because he picked dogs. He won because once he had chosen dogs, he applied huge amounts of effort to perfecting that single method of transporting the sledges. Had he shown up with just good enough dogs and drivers, he wouldn't have traveled so fast each day, and he might have lost the race. In our quantitative study of 5,000 people, we found that employees who chose a few key priorities and channeled tremendous effort into doing exceptional work in those areas greatly outperformed those who pursued a wider range of priorities. We asked people to gauge how much they prioritized and how much effort they put into their chosen priorities. We then formed a do-less-than-obsess score for each employee and analyzed the impact on performance. The predicted effect turned out to be substantial. People who were average at other practices but mastered do-less-than-obsess would likely place 25 percentage points higher in the performance ranking than those who didn't embrace this practice. Think about that difference. Say you start out as a middling performer at the 50th percentile of all employees and then move your do-less-than-obsess score from low, a do-more strategy, to high. Your performance now will be at the 75th percentile, meaning that you perform better than 74% of employees. That's pretty amazing. Do-less-than-obsess affects performance more than any other practice in this book. Consider the contrast between two people in our study. Their names and settings have been altered. One boss gave a low do-less-than-obsess score to Maria, a mortgage specialist in her 50s at a Milwaukee bank. "She gets overwhelmed," the boss said. "When there's too much work, she just tries to do it herself, as opposed to delegating it." Maria landed in the bottom 41% on the do-less-than-obsess principle. It was a different story with Kathy, a 56-year-old quality engineer at a company that manufactures car parts. She could narrow her attention to focus on the most important tasks at hand and could stick to the priorities she had set. Once, when Kathy had prioritized the product launches of four customers based on start dates, one customer pressured her to do them all at the same time. As she explained, "I had to say no. I'm not going to do this right now. I've got other customers that take priority." Kathy's boss scored her in the top 10% on the do-less-than-obsess practice. Kathy placed 15 points higher in the performance ranking than Maria, the difference between excellent and merely good. Many people we studied struggled to attain this kind of focus at work. Only 16% of the 5,000 people in our dataset scored very high on one of our question items. He or she is extremely good at focusing on key priorities, no matter how much work and how many things he or she has to do. A full 26% scored very low. I had expected that bosses would be better at focusing than low or mid-level employees. After all, they ought to have more freedom to determine how many tasks, projects, or responsibilities to take on. Yet, we found that roughly equal percentages of junior and senior level employees excelled at focusing, 15% and 17% respectively, and only a slightly greater percentage of junior employees were poor at focusing than their senior-level colleagues, 28% versus 23%. Far more people than we might imagine have at least some latitude in their job to focus their work activities. Of course, some job activities are fixed and cannot be changed. Others, however, are discretionary or can be modified. To see why you should focus, let's consider some drawbacks of the usual practice of piling on more tasks. Spread too thin. When executive search consultant Susan Bishop opened her own boutique firm in New York City, she had a clear idea of how to succeed. Our plan was to beat the larger, established competitors through superb execution, she explained. We accepted every client that called us and tried to make each one as happy as humanly possible. Bishop believed that putting her clients' happiness first would lead to greater customer satisfaction, which would lead to more business. She was right, up to a point. By saying yes to most requests, Bishop found that she reeled in more than enough clients, but she lacked the time and energy to do her job well. Over the next few years, she and her small team undertook searches with low pay, difficult bosses, and in unattractive locations. She expanded beyond her core expertise in media and entered industries she didn't know well, such as financial services and consumer products, and then had to scramble to obtain the necessary background knowledge. With her efforts spread across too many customer areas, her performance suffered. Sales and profits remained flat, even dipping in some years. Her margins languished at about 15%, half that of other search firms. The stress was just horrible, Bishop said. I felt pulled in 100 different directions. Her focus score in our survey assessment landed her in the bottom 20% in our 5,000-person sample. Like Bishop, many people are quick to say yes. Real estate agents are tempted to cover one more neighborhood. Engineers add one more product feature. Human resources employees take on one more assignment. Marketers agree to help a colleague with a campaign. Before we know it, taking on more responsibilities lands us in the same unfortunate situation as Bishop. But doing more has its advantages, doesn't it? If you work on more tasks, you get more done, and that pleases your boss. Spreading yourself across multiple clients or projects gives you more options. That's why Captain Scott brought 5 transportation methods to the South Pole. If the motor sledges conked out, Scott could use the dogs. If the dogs failed, he could rely on the ponies. Hedging your bets seems like a smart move, a good way to accomplish more. There are, however, 2 big problems with scattering your efforts in this way. The first is the spread-too-thin trap. Neither Bishop nor Scott could devote enough time and effort to mastering even one of their tasks. Bishop struggled to keep up with all of her client accounts, and Scott failed to acquire first-rate ponies. We all have a finite supply of attention to devote to our work responsibilities. As economics Nobel laureate Herbert Simon quipped, "A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention." The more items we attend to, the less time we can allot to each, and the less well we will perform any one of them. Hurt by complexity. A second problem with an increase in the scope of our activities is what I call the complexity trap. In racing to the South Pole, Captain Scott not only had to manage many modes of transportation, he also had to deal with their interrelationships, which proved difficult as they moved at different speeds. Coordinating between priorities requires mental exertion. Many regard multitasking as efficient, but research shows that rapidly toggling between 2 items, reading emails and listening to a colleague's presentation, for example, renders you less effective at both. Each time you switch, your brain must abandon one task and acclimate itself to the other. A study of 58,280 court cases before Italian judges in Milan found that the judges who handled many cases simultaneously, multitasking, took longer to complete them than those who performed them in sequence. The differences were striking. The slowest judge spent on average 398 days to close the cases, while the fastest took only 178 days, or less than half the time. They all had the same workload, and cases were assigned randomly, so their cases were comparable. The researchers estimated that a 50% increase in multitasking led to a nearly 20% increase in the number of days to finish cases. Toggling cases slowed them down. Other studies have shown that switching between tasks can decrease your productivity by as much as 40%. The complexity trap wreaks havoc inside companies. In the name of progress, we pile on goals, priorities, tasks, metrics, checkpoints, team members, and so on. But adding these items increases complexity, which we can define in terms of the number of items and the number of connections between them. It's no surprise that in our study, a full 65% of people strongly or completely agreed that their organization was very complex, many departments, policies, processes, and plans that require coordination. We don't need to add more work activities to excel. There's a better way to work, one that prevents us from falling into these spread-too-thin and complexity traps. If we select just a few items and obsess to excel in those, we can perform at our best. What does obsession look like in the workplace? Massage the octopus. For the past 50 years, 91-year-old Jiro Ono has operated the sushi restaurant Tsukiyabashi Jiro, tucked under the underpass of a subway station in Tokyo. The wooden doorway opens off to a corridor that resembles a B-class office space. You might also be disappointed by the menu. There isn't one. Jiro serves 20 pieces of sushi to the 10 guests seated at his minute counter. No pre-dinner cocktail, no tempura, no side dishes. Oh, and the bathroom is out in the subway corridor. Sounds like a recipe for failure. It would be if the sushi weren't so darn exquisite. Ono is considered the best sushi chef in the world, with not one, not two, but the maximum of 3 Michelin stars. He has devoted his life to the preparation of 20 pieces of sushi. But choosing this tiny set is not what makes him different. It is how he focuses that sets him apart. The marvelous 2011 documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, follows Jiro as he prepares the day's offerings. In the morning, his older son, who has trained with his father for 30 years, heads to the fish market to select a single superior piece of tuna. Not one of the best pieces, no. The best in the entire market. If Jiro can't have the single best tuna piece, he won't buy any tuna that day. How can you serve superior sushi if you don't have the single best slice of fish? Then it's time to prepare the octopus. Jiro massages the octopus by hand as part of its preparation to ensure its tenderness. But how long of a massage to give? Jiro used to give his octopus a 30-minute rub, but he discovered that octopus reaches peak tenderness when hand-massaged for 40 to 50 minutes. This task falls to an apprentice. Another apprentice, who has worked 10 years in the restaurant, the first 8 spent washing and preparing fish, graduated to the role of preparing the omelet sushi. But Jiro forced him to cook 200 omelet batches. 200! Before he was allowed to prepare one that was served to customers. When you make only 20 pieces, you can afford to obsess over each one. Jiro didn't just say, "Let's serve 20 presentable pieces." No. He channeled his full energies into each one, and he spent a lifetime perfecting them. The obsession to excel can take many forms, depending on your line of work. For the salesperson at Nordstrom, it's calling 5 other stores to find the exact size and color of the sweater a customer wants, having the sweater delivered to the customer's home, and then calling afterward to ask how it fit. For the real estate agent, It's spending an hour poring through hundreds of photos of a house she is listing for sale, looking for the single best image to feature on her company's website. For the elementary school teacher, it's preparing for the next day's class by rehearsing his lesson plan one more time, even though he has taught the class for 20 years. These people strive to produce exceptional quality. Stellar quality, whether it takes the form of a smartphone's intuitive user interface, a retail store's exceptional customer service, or a restaurant's superbly tender piece of octopus, requires both prolonged effort and a fanatic attention to detail. Attaining that quality demands obsession and focus. We often disparage obsessions in our daily lives, viewing them as dangerous or debilitating. But obsession can be a productive force. Greatness in work, art, and science requires obsession over quality and an extraordinary attention to detail. What many another writer would be content to leave in massive proportions, Ernest Hemingway reflected, I polish into a tiny gem. Alfred Hitchcock required more than 70 shots to perfect the shower scene in the movie Psycho. To create his famous vacuum cleaner, James Dyson created 5,000 prototypes. It took him 15 years. Now that's obsessing. I wondered if we would find a quantitative link in our data set between obsession-like work habits and performance. We plotted the 5,000 people in our study and grouped them into four types based on their degree of focus and obsession by measuring their degree of effort. The performance of the four types varied dramatically. The worst performing group consisted of people who took on many priorities, but then didn't put in much effort. They were the accept more than coast employees and ranked in the bottom 11th percentile. Ouch. The second lowest performing group at the 53rd percentile scored very high on extremely good at focusing on key priorities, but low on effort. We named this group Do Less, No Stress. These were the people in our study who selected a few priorities, but then failed to obsess. Just choosing to focus, as work productivity experts would have you do, does not lead to best performance. The second best performing group at the 54th percentile consisted of employees who accepted many responsibilities and then became overwhelmed as they worked hard to complete them. They scored low on focus and high on effort. We called this the Do More Than Stress group. Susan Bishop, the executive recruiter, landed in this category. She took on too many responsibilities, receiving a poor 3 out of 7 do less score, yet put in a huge amount of effort, a top score of 7. Notice that this group performed at roughly the same level as the do less, no stress group. That is, if you violate either the do less or the obsess criterion, your performance will remain about average, slightly above the 50th percentile. Finally, we have the Giros and Amundsens of the world, those who excelled at choosing a few priorities and channeling their obsession-like effort to excel in those areas. Their performance placed them in the 82nd percentile, a whopping 28 percentage points higher than the next category. And this effect is just for the do less than obsess practice. The other six practices in this book are not taken into account yet. So which group do you fall into? Be honest. I confess that I often belong in the do more than stress group. I take on too many tasks and struggle later with the follow-through. But the findings in this chapter have affected me, and I am working hard to move myself into the do less than obsess group. That means saying no more often and directing even more of my energies to the few remaining priorities. It also means paying attention to what weakens my focus. We asked people in our study what prevented them from doing less. I assumed most people don't focus because they're distracted. Almost weekly, it seems, an article pops up in the media about how overwhelmed people are by incoming communications, how much time they waste on social media, and how much FOMO, fear of missing out, they feel. causing them to peek at every text, email, or ping. But when our data came back, I discovered that these distractions were only part of the problem. The people in our study cited three main reasons for failing to focus: broad scope of work activities, including having too many meetings and too many work items; temptations, including distractions imposed by others and temptations created by oneself; and pesky do-more bosses who lack direction and set too many priorities. These three main reasons correspond in turn to three tactics we can deploy to do less and obsess. Let's look at how to narrow your scope. Slicing and Dicing with Friar William. Today, if you have a heart attack and are rushed to the hospital, you might glance up at the skilled doctors hovering over you and think, "Thank God, I made it here in time." Back in 2005, if you were rushed to the ThetaCare Regional Medical Center in Appleton, Wisconsin, you might not have considered yourself so lucky. The hospital had a terrible track record treating heart attacks, especially the most serious form, STEMI attacks. That's when an artery leading to the heart is entirely blocked. The heart muscles will start dying during a STEMI attack, so each minute during and after the attack is critical. Cardiothoracic surgeons must insert a tiny balloon into your artery and inflate it to clear the blockage. If they wait too long, you might not make it. How long is too long? As John Toussaint and Roger Girard relate in their insightful book, On the Mend, the golden rule is 90 minutes from entering the hospital to clearing the clog in surgery. That sounds like plenty of time, but a lot needs to happen to diagnose and prepare a patient for surgery. At ThetaCare in Appleton back in 2005, the staff only managed the 90-minute door-to-balloon goal in a paltry 65% of the cases, much worse than at the best hospitals. In other words, you had about a one-third chance of clearing your clog after 90 minutes had passed. Your risk of dying was much higher than at many other hospitals. Peggy Bree, a nurse manager in the emergency department and whom we interviewed for our study, remarked that she was very frustrated by that number. Peggy was born in a ThetaCare hospital herself, and she had worked in the emergency department for 5 years. She felt certain that her department could improve its performance treating heart attack victims, but how? Peggy and a few others in the department, including the emergency room chief physician, began examining what happened when a patient entered the emergency room complaining of chest pain. First, a triage nurse examined the patient, diagnosed a probable heart attack, and rushed the person to a room to perform critical tests, including an EKG. Then the emergency room doctor arrived and proclaimed, "Looks like a STEMI." They ran more tests. Afterward, a second doctor, a cardiologist, arrived and confirmed the STEMI diagnosis. That could take 20 minutes if the cardiologist was busy with other patients. Finally, the nurses and doctors prepared the patient for surgery. "We talked about every single step," Peggy recalled. "We asked, why do each step at all?" That led the group to suggest a crazy idea: get rid of the expert cardiologist. The cardiologists could barely contain themselves. "Remove the expert from the process? Are you nuts?" The cardiologists didn't think the emergency department physicians could be accurate in the diagnosis, Peggy recalled. Shouldn't they instead hire another cardiologist so that they could speed up the process? But Peggy and the others on the team pushed back. If the emergency room doctors learned to make the STEMI diagnosis when they first saw the patient, they wouldn't need the expert cardiologist to make a second diagnosis afterward. "Why perform the task of diagnosing twice?" they asked. The cardiologists were unconvinced. A break came when they visited another hospital that had already cut out the cardiologist step. The trip itself helped to build trust among the team. "It's amazing how well you get to know each other when you sit in a car together for 4 hours," Peggy reflected. Afterward, the cardiologists agreed to try it without their involvement, but on one condition: the emergency room physicians had to obsess to diagnose right the first time. Working with the cardiologists, Peggy and the team developed a plan that emergency room docs could use to diagnose a STEMI. The emergency room doctors underwent training. Once they tried the new setup, Peggy and the team held several meetings in which physicians,